This podcast is from the IDPF Digital Book 2012 Conference at Book Expo America.
We're going to switch gears now from talks to a interactive panel. So I would like to welcome to the stage three very esteemed publishers. So this is going to be a trade publisher panel. I would like to welcome Richard Charkin, the CEO of Bloomsbury. I would like to welcome Madeline McIntosh, the president of Random House Sales, Digital, and Operations. And I would like to welcome Jane Friedman, the CEO of Open Road Media. We can just all sit down here. We're going to make this interactive and informal. I guess I'm the only one with a standalone mic here. Thank you so much for coming. So we're going to make this interactive and take a number of questions from you during this next 40 minutes or so. So please get your questions ready. I will ask in advance that we don't have any questions regarding agency pricing, DOJ matters, and things like that. You could probably understand that it was hard enough to get major trade publishers to come and talk right now, given the delicate situation. And so we've got to understand that there's certain topics that really aren't appropriate to try to get a group conversation on. We'll see if they even respect that or not. This is an opportune time to note that this year we are recording all of our sessions, and later this month we'll make all the slides and podcasts, audio podcasts, available. So if you can't get to a particular track because you're going to something else, you can know that this year you're going to be able to get that content later. And for any of the DOJ special agents in the audience, you don't have to take good notes because you'll hear it all. You'll hear it all later. So let me kick it off by asking. Oh, go ahead, Jane.
Can I just say that I am not a trade publisher?
Well, okay, fair enough.
Okay, I am a digital publisher. I have been a trade publisher, but I just want to get that straight. My two colleagues are trade publishers.
Fair enough.
Thank you.
Can I make it straight?
Yes.
I am neither a trade publisher. I'm scientific and academic and digital, and I'm just a publisher.
So there you are, me too. There you
I am a global trade publisher in all formats, including digital.
Okay. Actually, I think many of you know Richard as a blogger, so I guess...
Right.
And many of you know also that Madeline has a history at Amazon, so she's been on that side as well. So let me ask the first question for you guys, and again, we'll make this conversational. I hope you can all talk, which is, we heard from Seth and from Ernie about having more direct relationships with your customers. How important is it for publishers to nurture direct relationships with your readers on a going forwards basis, and why, and what are you doing about that in your own house?
I think in a way it's vitally important. I think that when I look at how we're prioritizing it at Random House, it's less about trying to establish a brand name for us as a publisher with consumers, and much more about serving the author's relationship with the consumer. So if we, thinking about it practically, what that means is empowering an author who wants to sell direct, empowering an author who wants to market direct, we can act as in the background to help them do that at a global scale. It's not that I'm against trying to establish Random House as a brand name. I just don't think it's going to be nearly as effective as really supporting what we always have done, which is the author brand names themselves.
I think Madeline's absolutely correct. I mean, publishers have always looked as the author as the brand, and should, because most consumers don't know what publisher is publishing a book, and most consumers look for the author as brand. I think that it is extremely important to help the author in marketing his or her name and his or her product and his or her oeuvre. And that's where I think it has served us well at Open Road as a digital marketing company, which is really what we are.
Bill said, talked about direct relationship with customers. And it begs the question who the customer is.
Well, I hope I said reader, but if I didn't, I misspoke.
Initially you said customer,
okay,
so I'm going to pick you up
yeah,
on that.
Thank you.
In British publishers, there's a department called customer service. I suspect you have them as well. These people talk to retailers and wholesalers, frankly, neither of whom do I feel are true customers. They're partners, they're distributors, and our customers. The reader, as everyone said, is actually the customer of the author. So who is our customer? And I think it's the author. It always has been. So do we want direct relationships with our customers? Yes, it's the author. And we need to build stronger relationships. And I think if there's one criticism of our industry, it's that sometimes we are perceived as booksellers, sometimes perceived as intermediaries, but actually we're serving our authors, and if we were doing that better, the rest would sort itself out.
So let me follow up on that, if I may, which is in the service of helping authors, with whether you call it digital marketing or calling them your customers, how important is it for publishers to engage in direct selling? Again, going forward and with a focus on digital.
Yeah. Well, we are not a direct seller. We have very good relationships with all the retailers and e-tailers. And I think it's most incumbent upon the publisher to help the author. I think that there are publishers who are selling directly to the consumer, but there are certainly some e-tailers and retailers who do that very well. So for our feeling is we want to know who our reader is by marketing extensively. We want to be able to get to them faster, quicker, more efficiently, and you can do that through the internet. I mean, I've been a marketer all my life, and when I talk about 30 years ago, what it was like to find a group of people who wanted a certain topic, a certain subject, it was impossible. It was lots of research. Now you kind of press a button, you Google it, and you have it. So to me, it's incumbent upon all of us to help our authors market themselves and help us market directly to the consumer, but not necessarily sell to that consumer.
Madeline, Richard?
I hold in my brain two different points of view on this simultaneously. The one is that fundamentally, I don't think that we add value either to the author or to the reader by competing with booksellers. I think booksellers have a hard enough job, all of them, whether they're big or they're small, they have a hard enough job making a fantastic customer service environment. And I think, you know, us trying to compete with them in that regard is not productive. At the same time, I think that that we do have authors who it turns out that it's not that they want to compete with booksellers, but they have a vital interest in maintaining information about their own customers, their customers, the readers. And that in many of those cases, some of our most innovative authors, for example, in the business category, are really asking us to help them to sell directly to consumers simply so that they can retain customer data, because they don't like the fact that when they pass that data on to the retailer, it's essentially a lost asset. So that's kind of the one context in which I think that in service to the author, sometimes we do have to to be better as direct sellers.
But haven't we always done that, Madeline? Haven't we always had authors out giving speeches, and we've helped them sell directly
to their
customer?
But
I mean, that's just part of
what they want to do is a little bit more evolved now, in that they really, you know, we have authors who want to be doing, polling of their customers on a daily basis to collect feedback related to what the cover should look like in their next book or how content evolves. So the author's needs have evolved.
Well, and Richard, I mean, Pottermore.com might be the non-parallel example of a author directly selling at this moment. So, what's your feeling about that? Is that a one-off by the unique characteristics of that series, or is that and the author, or is that the pattern for the future?
Well, I think it's fairly safe to say that Pottermore and Harry Potter are one-offs.
Yes.
I don't think we should draw conclusions. However, I'd just like to come back, because what Pottermore is trying to do is to create a community of interest. Mm-hmm. And whilst I completely support everything that's been said about working with retailers, whether e-tailers or retailers, and not wanting to compete with them, some areas, particularly specialist areas, they aren't very good at it. And if I could give you one example, which will be almost entirely meaningless to this audience, it is to do with cricket. We publish something called Wisden, which is the annual thing. It's been going for 149 years. Wars, famines, it's never missed a year. It comes out with statistics and reports and things. And we sell 40,000 copies in hardback at $80 a pop every year. Of those copies, I think 35,000 go through the book trade. But the book trade don't know they're selling them. They don't actually keep a record of who the people bought them. And of course, it's the same people buy it every year, more or less. Some die, some new ones come in, but essentially same people every year. We would be doing a really rotten job if we didn't offer the people who buy that the opportunity to buy it direct, and not just to buy it direct, because it is a community, so we can sell cheap air flights to follow the England cricket team to the West Indies. We can offer dinners with fancy cricketers if people want. We can offer TV and various other things. The building of communities actually takes us a step closer to our real audience, the readers, in this particular instance. Mm-hmm. So I think there are two types.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
But that is very promotional, and I think that is essential. I think it is the building of communities, the social communities, or what we call the passion communities, the areas where people very specifically want to know about a very specific topic. I just don't think that you then have to sell to them directly. I think you can still work with your e-tailer. But I'm not sure I want to debate this, because I think that there is, we all have to do better jobs. We have to do better jobs holding on to that consumer and getting that consumer to buy something. Because once that consumer buys something, perhaps that consumer will then buy from the e-tailer, so, or the retailer. So I think the important thing is getting to the passion communities, having them see what they want. They don't even know they want it. Letting them know they want it and then making that sale.
Jane, that leads me to another question I want to ask you. And then in a couple minutes, we'll start to get some audience questions, which is, how is digital, how are e-books changing that equation? Are they changing the kind of content that makes sense? When you're talking about things that are born digital, what is that changing about the way you guys are doing business?
We could actually play a drinking game, and I can answer almost every question
wow.
here with
okay.
With referring to Shades of Grey, which for anybody in this audience who somehow does not know what Shades of Grey is, this is an erotica trilogy, which written by E.L. James, an author who, you know, rewind maybe 6 months ago, and people did not know who she was. She then self-published in generally in ebook form and available POD, but really mainly in ebook, and then sold a couple hundred thousand copies. And then starting in March, Random House struck a deal with her, became her worldwide publisher, and in, I think, the first 9 weeks, we together then sold 10 million copies across digital and print. And the reason that I refer to this in this context is that, to me, when people ask, well, what's your self-publishing strategy? For me, the point is that one of the great great bonuses of the advent of self-publishing, particularly in the digital context, is that it allows for many, many, many more people to enter the fray and bring their content to light. For those that then rise up to a certain level, that's where I think a scale publisher such as ourselves jumps in and makes it available in both print and digital. And what we've seen in an incredible way is that as soon as the print copies flooded, we were able to finally get the print copies into the market at a scaled level, that it had a direct positive impact on the digital copies. So the digital demand led to print demand. The print demand then sustained digital demand, and you've had this this.
So you're saying shelf space still matters. And
shelf space,
by the way,
matters
10 million copies is a heck of a lot of shelf space.
It's a heck of a lot, and about half of that is print.
So it's still half digital. So this
it's half digital.
That might be the first 5 million copies selling ebook, right? I mean,
I don't know that for sure, but it's only a lot of copies.
Yeah.
And I think the point is, going back to what one of Seth's point was, that there still is not a cash register effect online. None of the online retailers, however brilliant they are, have really created true, ways for people to really discover new books online. Generally, people go to online retailers and buy the book that they already are aware that they want to purchase.
I don't actually agree with that. I think that if you market, the discoverability comes from marketing. But I would just like to say something, because 50 Shades of Grey and Harry Potter are the phenoms. We've all lived through them. They come and they go. I'd like to talk about, for 1 second, the number one bestseller that we had 2 weeks ago, which was called A Night to Remember. How many of you know that book? It was published 55 years ago. It's the book about the sinking of the Titanic. And what we're saying is, we, with marketing against that milestone, made that book the number one bestseller in the New York Times that week. We also helped, and I think this is a really important point, we also helped Henry Holt sell a lot of copies of their paperback. So I wanted to say that about what Ernie had said, which is, does one move the other? Well, we can give you example after example after example that in our case with deep backlist, which is the basis of our business, that helps to move print sales.
Can I give a little case study? Because we were beaten up by Shades of Grey. The Monday before last, we launched a book that we'd never heard of about a month before. It was a book called The Twitter Diaries. It came to us via a literary agent who said, "Oh, just publish it, will you?" So we said, okay. And we decided to do it in ebook only. 3 weeks ago, it was first I'd heard of it. They said, "I heard about it, and we're publishing it on Monday," 2 weeks ago. I said, "Well, why not do a print version simultaneously?" And there was a debate, and we said, "Yes, why not?" "Oh, well, we haven't told Amazon about the print, and we haven't told Smiths, and there will be nothing in the airports, and oh, gosh, well." But I said, we must. At which point, someone came up and said, "The print might cannibalize the e-book sales, I thought this was a moment in history. So I'll circulate that date and you can put it into the history books. But then what happened was we published on a Monday. These are first-time authors, effectively. A book called Twitter Diaries. As Jane was saying, it's about marketing. We got Piers Morgan to tweet about it and a guy called Alan Sugar in England, who's a very big tweeter. And it started climbing up the thing, and at 11 o'clock it was at number 1,000. By lunchtime it was number 100. And this was the day we were announcing the Bloomsbury results to the City of London. So I was in and out of meetings. And every time I said, it's going to go to number 1. By close of play, it was number 4. God damn it.
Yeah.
Almost
right.
Pretty right.
But after the promotion, and here's the point, it held at number 4, and it's continued to hold way above, and we're about to launch it big in the US, I think, this week, with Piers Morgan again doing his stuff. But we will launch the paperback, and it is getting the most fantastic support from retailers across the world. And so there is something in everything you say.
Well, one more question, and then I would like to ask the audience to help ask you guys some questions and get some conversation flowing about what they want to hear about. The question is about changing the way you operate. And Richard, your last case study may have partially answered it, because I don't think 5 years ago the idea that you published a book that a month ago you hadn't heard of would have happened, much less that you were worried about print cannibalizing E. But to what degree, and this is really more for Richard and Madeline running quote, traditional publishers, to what degree do you need to act like a startup or nurture startups within your companies in this disruptive time, and how are you doing that? How are you making that happen?
Well, if I could try and take it, anyone who isn't acting like a startup has a serious problem, because actually our industry is about nickel and diming. We are a nickel and dime industry. We can't charge more than people will pay. We have to pay what we have to pay, and we have to do what we have to do. And so our overheads and all that sort of thing are really, really vital. I mean, there's something I discovered just last week, so here's the thing. We're a small or a medium-sized publisher. We're not Random House or HarperCollins. And yet, we have 250 people visiting bookstores, subscribing new books for us worldwide, out of a total company of only 450. Now, some of them are employed, some are freelance, but it's 250. How many people do we have selling and thinking about digital? And I think the answer is probably a handful. So have we got...
You probably have more than that.
Well, we all are to some extent, exactly. But these people are going into bookshops only selling new books, effectively.
We made a very conscious decision, actually, to have the people that what we decided was one of our greatest assets. If we're going to make it through this transition, we have to at least take advantage of our greatest assets. And one of them is absolutely our sales force. And they know not just the new books, they know the entire list of Random House books ever published better than anyone else in the company does. They're passionate about books. They are work at a local level. And so we just decided to let them take the reins of their own destiny and really transform themselves. So they are absolutely working as social marketers on a local level as at the same time as they're selling in all formats. So.
And that's the lesson.
Yeah.
That resource, the 200 people...
Yeah.
Have to learn a new business.
Yeah.
Sitting in the center, I agree.
Okay. All right, well, let's get some questions. If you have questions, please come to that center mic and line up. And please ask your question and then kind of move to the side so the next person can get ready so we can keep it flowing. And I could be asking questions to these folks all day. So I'd rather have yours, though. So please
come ask
up.
Some questions.
Yeah, they don't want me to ask them all day. Go ahead, please.
Good morning, Jared Rosen. What do you see of the future DRM and how that's... Do you think that we're entering a non-DRM phase of digital publishing? How will that impact your industry?
You want me to take this one? I have perhaps a particular personal view on this because before I went to Amazon, I was the publisher of Random House Audio, and we were the first audio publisher to take off DRM. And what we learned from that is that it had virtually no impact on anything, that it did not particularly lead to an increase in piracy. It did not particularly lead to an increase in the number of retailers who were selling our audiobooks. So when I look at now the DRM debate that is emerging, I think that they're going to be that a year from now we'll be sitting here and there will be both major publishers and small publishers who will have launched experiments or totally taken DRM-free off or done things with watermarking. I think it's a red herring. I think that unless what you're doing is the reason to take DRM off from my perspective would be if we were doing it to enable a new way to sell books and that it was something that consumers actually wanted. I don't think that people are buying onto the Kindle because somehow they have handcuffs on them. I think that they're buying onto the Kindle because it's a good customer experience. The same for the Nook, the same for Apple. So I'm neither pro nor anti taking DRM off. I just think we have to be really clear about what the goal is and make sure that there's a real commercial reason to do it and not just kind of an artificial feeling that it will set us free.
Just to add to that, I mean, I also am unclear, although I'm leaning toward no DRM. I think that very much of this is educating the agents and the authors because all of our book contracts say that we will protect from piracy, et cetera. I think that what Madeline said is absolutely true. We're not aware of piracy being increased, certainly on the E side. In fact, more piracy on the P side, on the physical side, than on the E side, in my experience. So I think that you will probably see from us moving away from DRM. You know what? You can always put it back if you've made a mistake. And I think that that's part of what this world is today. The experimentation, the doing things to see if we can make a better experience. And if it doesn't work, we put it back on.
Richard?
One other aspect, which I'm technologically illiterate, but one other aspect that would concern me about a DRM, utterly DRM-free environment, is to do with territorial rights. Now, if in the English language, publishers published globally their products, then I wouldn't have a problem. That's absolutely right, and I think I've been a long-term advocate of global English rights. While those aren't in place, because certain authors and certain agents wish to restrict certain territories, it's really valuable to have that in the DRM and have it monitored. Mm.
All right, next question, please. Somebody else is behind you there. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Caleb Mason, and I heard you talk a lot about the importance of booksellers, which I understand because you're in the traditional industry. But I'm someone who left book publishing in the 80s and went into the photography industry and saw what happened with digital photography replacing 4,500 photo mats and parking lots, Ritz cameras, a lot of retailers that were totally disrupted by digital photography, and they're gone, not to mention all the volume of film processing that was done at CVS and Rite Aid and Walgreens. That's all gone. So I'm just curious, on the one hand I hear you don't have a brand of your own, which doesn't seem like a great place for a business to be in, and I would argue a little bit, I think you do have a brand of your own, but the author is an important brand. But seriously, as you look at this change, I mean, how do you respond to that if you're talking to the investment community, for instance, that I don't have a brand, and I'm dependent upon these booksellers that are closing down in big numbers. How am I going to take control of my own destiny? Thank you.
It's a very interesting question. I mean, being venture capital backed, I mean, the point is that we are reaching consumers in a different, in all ways. And I think that the booksellers are still an extremely, I mean, Seth, I think, talked about libraries being community places. Well, I think booksellers traditionally have been, and if they can get back to be that that community-focused place, that will be good. The booksellers, the traditional booksellers, have to learn how to sell digitally. I mean, they can't have their bookstores being showrooms and then somebody going out and buying the book from an online e-tailer. So I think this is all, it's all evolving, but I believe wholeheartedly that there is definitely still room for the bookseller. And I just think the bookseller has to get smarter, as we all have to get smarter.
I do have to deal with the investment community a bit. And, of course, we get that question and the various questions surrounding, naturally. One of the things I point them to is a case study, which is that in the early 1990s, the scientific publishing community, publishing, was challenged by the internet. How was it going to deal with it? We used to sell print copies to university libraries at high prices, and it was a great business. How is this going to be changed when every scientist can have access on their desk to material? That has turned out to be one of the greatest boons to the industry, mm-hmm. known to man, woman, or child. What happened was that the industry was flexible. It invested hundreds, literally hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in building digital platforms. It worked with its authors to improve the quality of the content, worked with the libraries to ensure that everyone at Harvard, Stanford, or wherever had access, built a business model which was based on subscription and the number of usage, ultimately on usage. And what's happened is that the price of a scientific article has fallen at least tenfold, perhaps a hundredfold, one can play with the numbers, and yet the profitability of the industry has held, and there's still growth. I think it's a fantastic achievement. Now, it doesn't mean that the game's over yet, because there are challenges all over the place, but it is absolutely possible to be a publisher in the digital world and hold, grow sales, and indeed grow profits. It's a challenge, but it's a huge opportunity, and people are rising to it.
Great. Next question, please.
Here, over here.
Where, in the back? Are we in the back?
Yonder.
Sorry. Thanks.
Thank you.
Please go ahead.
More and more major publishers are now issuing e-originals. So my question is, how will those publishers retain their brand and their identity without a tangible product sold through brick-and-mortar stores.
I agree. I think we're all doing a lot with e-original publishing. I don't think of it as something that means that we have less value because there's no physical artifact of it. I think that we are trying it in some cases as kind of a bridge, a short story in a way between major novels by big commercial fiction authors who are doing it in opportunistic ways to respond to current events. And the consumer demand is all over the place. In some cases, it's a couple thousand copies. In some cases, it's a 250,000 copies. And I do believe we don't really reach the full maximum potential of a book or an author unless we really are meeting demand in both formats, meaning everywhere you can buy a book, you find it in both formats. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't also experiment with digital original, quick publishing, something that you learn about on Monday and publish on Friday. So it's, to me, it's just part of a continuum of trying different flavors of publishing.
I think that, Madeline, you touched on two different things. E-originals, we have a small part of our business are e-originals. It's about 10% of our business. And we also don't have the same expectations of our e-originals that a traditional publisher might have, which is just fine because we've found this to be quite profitable. But in talking in terms of the short form, which is something that we are experimenting with, we are experimenting with organizations where we are co-publishing. For example, there's a news organization called ProPublica, which is a long-form journalistic association, and we are adding a little top and bottom and some photography, and that those are becoming shorts. I know you've all heard about shorts. We also have just... We are co-publishing with Esquire magazine with new fiction coming out simultaneously with e-books, short e-books, as well as their, at the same time as their magazine is producing those stories. So there are lots of different ways to look at that. I think that e-originals, in our case, what we call e-originals, we always had a print-on-demand capability. So if someone wanted the book in paper, they could get it. But, you know, what is a book, I ask? I mean, a book is a collection of ideas, and we are just have just been trained that those ideas have to be between hard covers and soft covers, but the consumer is telling us that, that those ideas can be consumed in ways that don't necessarily need to be bound.
And just to answer the branding issue... Bloomsbury itself has a history of branding, nothing to do with physical books. First of all, there was the Bloomsbury Group, who did all sorts of things to each other about 100 years ago. We're still getting on with it. So that was helpful. The second thing that helped was that we always put the word Bloomsbury on the front of our covers. Such that when a book called Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone came out and Amazon bought a lot of and sold a lot of copies, not only in the UK but also into America because the Scholastic edition hadn't come out, all over America the word Bloomsbury was on the front of what was the hit of the year of several years. And of course... It was seeing it on Amazon that made the difference in the first place. It was a digital brand. And so I'm not really too fussed about whether we're in print or not. The importance is that the quality is maintained and the quality of service that we give to the author is maintained so the authors say nice things about us. That's real branding. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Before we go to the next question, I want to just interject a follow-up for what Jane said in this line of discussion, which is... We haven't talked yet about enhanced or interactive content. And do we think that the job of, quote, book publishers is limited to things that are expressed in text, whether it's digitized or print, or will there be new types of content expression that may not match the pattern of even what we think of as a book in a printed world? Because Shades of Grey may have sold half ebooks, half print, but the ebooks pretty much is the same thing as the print book. Mm-hmm. And in 3 years, is that not going to be the case anymore? What's your guys' predictions, and what are you doing about that?
Well, one thing we're doing is experimenting and trying different things. I think we're doing that in the face of not a lot of consumer demand so far. So very willing to take key authors, premier brands, like the new Michelle Obama book that just went on sale about gardening in the White House. We very consciously decided just to see how we could take that book and the First Lady's interest and fuse those together in a way that would take maximum advantage of what tablets could do.
And we're going to have a session on that, I think, later in the program.
Lisa
McCoy-Kelly.
Yes,
right now,
so. I do recommend that you look at that. But I would say at this point, I don't think we're limited by thinking that we're just playing in text. I think, I'm willing to grab any format of media that that will work to expand an author's audience. But I do need to stay pragmatic at a certain point that we have not seen consumers particularly grabbing for multimedia experiences.
I agree. The consumer has not really asked for this as yet, but we have given it to them in a couple of ways. You may remember the iconic book Chaos by James Glick, which was published many, many years ago. That was one of our first ebooks, and all I could think of is that when you talk about pendulum theory, you want to see something going like this. So we, in a sense, put some infographics into our book. Now, of course, it can only be handled on the tablet, etc., but we felt that was worthwhile. But I do have to make mention of a book that we have just brought out that was written to be an enhanced ebook, and it's called Gift, by a woman called Andy Buchanan, who is the best-selling author of The Dangerous Book for Girls, which I published at Harper a long, long time ago. Well, not that long ago, but a few years ago. It seems like a long time ago. Anyway, Andy wrote this book called Gift, which is a ghost story, and the book was written to be an enhanced book, and it's wonderful. It has triggered events where words disappear. It has music. It has original songs from a YouTube sensation. It is really quite incredible. We are also doing it as a physical book, and it will be out in the fall as a physical book, and without, obviously, the enhancements. But the truth is the consumer is still not looking at this as a must-have. I believe that when all is said and done, Gift and other books like that will have great success, but it's going to take time, and that's my opinion.
Richard, anything to add?
Well, the only thing, I'm feeling rather old today, so we're doing a bit of history. I remember when the CD-ROM thing happened. I was a medical editor, and we published anatomy textbooks. And we were approached by I cannot tell you how many software companies, because obviously if you could digitize the human body and then do slices and look at it and do this and that,
fabulous.
Everyone would go for it. And they produced some brilliant, brilliant products. No one bought them because medical students don't study anatomy for more than about 20 hours a year. We as publishers knew that, but they as technologists did not. Of course, that sort of thing exists. So I have a little bit of uncertainty about it. But clearly with children's book publishing in certain fields, cookery, gardening, there will be some wonderful, wonderful products generated.
Great. All right, let's get back to the audience. Are there any questions over on this side? Is there a floating mic there? No, I think there's another question here, right? Somebody there for a question?
I think he was first.
No, okay, please, sir.
Hi there. Good morning. My name is Ralph Lazaro. I have a quick question just in reference. I'd love to hear your comments a little bit further about DRM that we were talking about, and I apologize for opening
the can. Wait, did you ask the last question about DRM?
No,
it's a different person. Okay.
He might have looked like me. But. And I know that could be a whole separate session on its own, so I'm not asking us to go too deep here, but I hear the comment about we're for or not for DRM, and I think that's something we've heard a lot from the publishing industry over the last year or two, and trying to figure out, should it be there or should it not? And to paraphrase Howard Zinn, it's hard to be indifferent on a moving train. And right now the train is moving with DRM, and we're seeing a few companies that you guys all referenced emerging as the leaders, and you could make the argument the only ones selling digital content, really, So what is the strategy? And part of that is because it's a great consumer experience. We all recognize that. Those three or four companies have the best experience. But you could make the argument that DRM has caused the smaller retailers and distributors has not enabled them to be able to sell digital content because of the way that the formatting is done and because those big guys have their own formats and their own DRMs. So what are you guys doing as publishers to help enable those smaller retailers and distributors to help sell digital content, knowing with the idea that DRM is sort of one of the things that's crippling their ability to sell that content?
Well, I think the problem is that DRM is only one of the things. I wish it were only DRM. If that were the only problem for them, I would probably put this towards at the top of my list of things to tackle this week. But take the Pottermore example, which is probably the best example we're going to get this year anyway, of a real live case study of take content that people want and take the DRM off and watch to see what happens. Even in that case, if you are a consumer who wants to read this on a Kindle, the fact that the DRM is not there does not mean that it's as seamless a process as just it would be if you were buying an ebook from Amazon wirelessly to get it onto your Kindle. It's a multi-step sideloading process. I think that people at Pottermore are amazed that as many people are going through those many steps as they are. So is the problem that people are hampered by the DRM, or is the problem that the consumers want to read the content on specific devices? And unless those specific devices somehow have a relationship with these small retailers, we're not going to be able to enable any kind of a different, better consumer experience, and that's going to hold those small businesses back. So
anyone want to add anything?
I wish I had the answer here, but it's
okay.
One
right.
of the biggest problems.
We have about two more questions. Thank you. Next question there in the center.
Thank you. When Grace Murray Hopper was helping to invent computing in the 1960s, she said, "The great thing about standards is that there are so many to choose from." But I don't want to ask you any more about DRM. I'd like to ask you about how you see digital publishing affecting what we call the row market, the rest of the world, or emerging markets, whatever you what might choose to use. And I have an example with me. One laptop per child.
I think it's one of the most important questions and one of the biggest challenges for us. The opportunity to reach out and sell books in Papua New Guinea, in Bolivia, in multiple languages, and we're very Anglo-centric as an industry, is fantastic. To give you an example. We're starting in India this year, Bloomsbury, our own business, and we've said that our first priority is to become a digital publisher for India. It allows us to be flexible in our pricing. It allows us to reach out into the country areas as well as the urban areas. It allows us to act fast. We can create books in multiple languages simultaneously and get them out there at an affordable price. I think it's the best thing that's happened, and I'm very glad you asked the question.
And I couldn't agree more. I think that certainly with mobile devices that are going to be ever-present around the globe, even before computers themselves, we are looking very much to be a global publisher. We have already formed alliances in Italy and in Spain, and I expect to have many more within the next few months. And obviously, India is a place that's of great interest. China is of great interest. I mean, it's obvious, but there are other places that are not so obvious that we also feel that with digital content, we can reach them fast, efficiently, and really spread the wonderful word of our authors.
Just a quick stat I'd offer up is that one of the most fun reports I get to look at is the one that shows in which countries our ebooks are selling. And on a weekly basis, it's more than 100 countries. Wow. So it's absolutely one of the great advantages of digital.
Absolutely.
Right. Thank you. Last question. I think there's somebody here who has a question.
Hi. I just to close up. It has something to do with DRM, peripherally, I guess. And I commend you all for selling to libraries, but I wonder if any of you could address what you think the top fear or issue is that so many publishers have with marketing ebooks to libraries.
I think it's about libraries. Oh. So I think the fear factor with libraries, and yes, let's acknowledge that we all here sell to libraries. I think the top fear factor that people are dealing with is that if you are a publisher who is serving authors, you need to make sure that you are making them available and sustaining an ecosystem that is about not just about libraries, but also about bookstores. And so for the first time, really, with digital, you have the potential that you could have, we always had this idea before that these were two separate populations. Now you could have simply a merging together of one population that says, why would I pay for these books in the through the bookstore site when it's so easy for me just to download them for free from the libraries? So I think that what you have some publishers clearly feeling that that is a very big threat. In our case, we've decided that there is a that there needs to be a balance. We need to make sure that we're creating an ecosystem that will be okay for both bookstores and libraries, but very much recognizing the fact that one of the main values that libraries can continue to offer to authors and readers and publishers is helping at the local level for people to discover books in all formats. So,
yeah, libraries are extremely important to us. We have never stopped selling to them. We understand that they may be a different audience, but as Madeline just said, I have been saying everywhere I can that I think that they are a merging audience. I think that we have seen that a book can be downloaded from a library for free, and if the book is the first of a series, the next two books in the series are bought from a bookstore. I think that from an e-tailer. I think that libraries are as important today as they have always been, and I would hope that our publishers, all of our publishers, will come up with some way that each one can live with. And we'll see what that is.
3 years ago at Bloomsbury, we set up something called publiclibraryonline.com, which you can look at, which is a different business model, which allows librarians to lend PDF versions of books to all their members. It's controlled. We pay the authors a royalty off their money. We represent not just our own books, but other publishers' books. We've been running for 3 years. We haven't had a single cancellation from a library. We now serve, I think it's 15 or 20 million population within the UK of 60 million. We have deals now in the Netherlands, in Belgium, and in Denmark, and we are looking to extend it. And just have a look. It's a different business, but I won't bore you with it. But there are ways, with a bit of imagination, that librarians can fulfill their hugely important role in society.
And we'll have a panel on libraries.
Great.
And exploratory business models later today. Richard, it seems like next week we might have to get you on that panel as well, not just a publisher. I want to thank Richard and Jane and Madeline for giving their busy time. They've got businesses to run, and I think it's great that they've shared with you some of this conversation today. And so please give them a big round of applause.